Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure and Free Speech and Election Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, June 29, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Supreme Court's ruling Monday in McDonnell v. United States. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're very pleased to welcome experts Professor Randall Eliason, Will Hahn, Steve Klein, and Tara Malloy. More complete bios are provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here to reserve more time for their presentations, followed by some back and forth, and then your questions. And with that, Will Hahn, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Will, and it's a pleasure to be with you all and to be with the Federalist Society and talk about a very consequential case from the Supreme Court's recently concluded term, McDonnell versus United States. I know we've gone through the facts of this case on earlier calls, but just to give a sort of very high-level overview. So former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell was indicted in January of 2014 for accepting payments, loans, gifts, and other things of value from a Virginia businessman named Johnny Williams, who's the CEO of a company called Star Scientific, in exchange, according to the indictment, for performing official actions on an as-needed basis as opportunities arose to legitimize, promote, and obtain research studies for Star Scientific's products, specifically Anatoblock, which Johnny Williams was seeking to have FDA approval for, and sought research studies from the University of Virginia and Virginia Commonwealth University to help facilitate FDA approval. The Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, ultimately found that the acts set forth in the indictment could not, on the facts here, constitute official action as it's defined in the federal bribery statutes, which was the controlling definition for Governor McDonnell's honest services fraud and Hobbs Act counts. The specific actions that the government alleged that Governor McDonnell took in favor of Johnny Williams were at least the following five. Arranging meetings for Johnny Williams with Virginia government officials who were subordinates of the governor to discuss and promote Anatoblock, hosting and attending events at the governor's mansion designed to encourage research studies at Virginia's public universities, contacting other government officials in the governor's office to encourage these research studies, promoting Star Scientific's products and facilitating its relationships with Virginia government officials, and then recommending that senior government officials in the governor's office meet with Johnny Williams to discuss ways to facilitate the studying of Anatoblock. A jury ultimately found Governor McDonnell guilty of the counts that he violated the Honest Services Fraud Statute and the Hobbs Act Statute. And the jury instructions from the district court were ultimately found by the Supreme Court to have a very unbounded interpretation of official action. Those jury instructions were affirmed by the Fourth Circuit, and the governor appealed the jury instructions as well as the sufficiency of the evidence that was given to the jury to convict Governor McDonnell, along with some other challenges that weren't raised at the Supreme Court. So getting to the opinion itself, the Supreme Court unanimously found that that the definition used in the jury instructions to define official action was unbounded. That's how the Supreme Court characterized it, because it wasn't connected to the exercise of government power or the threat or pressure to do so. The Supreme Court, in a way that I think would have made Justice Scalia very proud, did a very careful textual analysis of the definition of official act in 18 U.S.C. 201, and relied upon various canons of statutory construction to ensure that the broader words in the statute, like question or matter, were given a reading that does not render the remainder of the definition, specifically more narrower words like proceeding and controversy and suit, superfluous. It carefully looked at the facts to see whether the various official acts alleged in the indictment, making phone calls, arranging a meeting, hosting a product launch event, asking an aide to see you about an issue, whether these constituted either questions or matters under the statute, as well as whether they constituted decisions or actions. The court then very carefully distinguished the district court's jury instructions on official action in light of to see whether the acts at issue were actually pending before Governor McDonnell, and compared the very high level of generality that the district court took towards whether or not there were actually pending questions or matters relating to Star Scientific and Anadoblock before the governor, with the more Fourth Circuit's more specific and focused understanding of what specific questions or matters are before the governor on this issue. The district court, as I said, took a very broad interpretation of this, looking at the fact that Governor McDonnell ran for governor being a promoter of job creation. His slogan, Bob's for Jobs, was repeated often to the jury by the government. And whether or not simply being interested in economic development meant that issues related to economic development were always before the governor. As I said, the Fourth Circuit took a more narrower view of that and focused specifically on the questions about Star Scientific and the research studies as to being before the governor. And this is an important distinction because the second piece of the challenge dealing with the sufficiency of the evidence requires the court, according to the Supreme Court, requires the Fourth Circuit to go back and review the evidence and see whether or not Governor McDonnell would be able to be retried to under this narrower understanding of official act that comports with every single aspect of the statutory definition. And it also comports with, as the Supreme Court described it, the significant constitutional concerns raised by both Governor McDonnell and his supporters. In the interest of full disclosure on that point, I should say that while serving as a lawyer at Huntington Williams, I drafted several amicus briefs in support of the governor's position on behalf of various business leaders, policy advocates, and former and current elected officials, discussing some of these constitutional concerns, both with respect to the First Amendment, but also the vagueness concerns of the Honest Services Fraud Statute and the Hobbs Act, in relation to this prosecution and the government's purported definition of official action. And as I said earlier, this is an opinion I think that in a number of ways would make Justice Scalia very proud, not only because there was such a careful textual analysis, but also because the opinion in many ways I think reads as a follow-on and a complement to Justice Scalia's opinion for the court in the Sundiamond case. Again, acknowledging that some of the words in these statutes could be read in a very broad way, but that in order to cure the absurdities that could come as a function of giving them an unbounded interpretation, you read these words in a more narrower way to not read out other words in the statute, but also to be aware of the, as the court described them, the significant constitutional concerns of essentially saying that, well, in terms of a quid pro quo agreement, virtually anything can be a quid and anything can be a quo. And if anything can be a quid, including a campaign contribution or something as innocuous as a lunch, and anything can be a quo, meaning something as innocuous as sending a polite blow-off email to a constituent, then you have opened up a situation in which all of politics could be criminalized depending upon the proclivities of the prosecutor looking at the facts of the case, making it very difficult to develop compliance programs with public corruption laws, but also respecting a principle that, though not directly discussed in the Supreme Court's opinion, I would have a very difficult time understanding the significant constitutional concerns without thinking about these cases, the Citizens United and McCutcheon cases that talk about the government's inability to simply go after the ingratiation and access that can come from robust political participation. The court has a line about there being an assumption in representative democracy that there is a sort of transactional aspect to constituent services, and that the remedies for this need to be very carefully tailored so as to avoid chilling robust political participation. So I think on the whole, this is a very strong, carefully analyzed opinion with great application of fact to law and textual analysis. And I think it will put the Justice Department in an uphill position should it want to reconsider charging and pursuing Governor McDonnell again. And one other point I think is worth mentioning before I turn it over to Randall is that the court did a very good job, as I mentioned, very careful job, distinguishing, defining what an official action is for purposes of the bribery statutes, and also defining quid pro quo. There wasn't a dispute among the parties that a quid pro quo agreement is required and is the definition of corruption. It's not to say that official action is something that's grafted onto the this for that requirement, but that the agreement has to be one that is, as the court said in Evans and quoted in McDonnell, in exchange for specific official acts. So I think it's almost an exercise in question begging to say that the governor wasn't addressing the issue of quid pro quo agreement. The question was, well, what was the nature of the agreement? What was the exchange for? And do the official acts as alleged in the indictment constitute the type of exercise of government power that can constitute specific official acts? And on the facts of this case, the court unanimously found that they did not. And with that, I'll turn it over to Randall.
Thank you, Will, and thanks to the Federalist Society for the chance to be here. I mean, Will did a great job summarizing the opinion and the holding, I think, so I won't dwell on that any further. And like you said, the key to the opinion is this very specific focus on one definition of official act in one specific federal statute, the federal bribery statute, which, interestingly enough, is a statute with which McDonnell was not charged. And yet that became the focus of trying to define federal bribery for all purposes. And in my view, that focus on the question of official act and that particular focus on that question alone is the flaw in the opinion. Because what this what it does is ends up focusing solely on the quo aspect of a quid pro quo corrupt bribery scheme instead of focusing on the entire corrupt agreement, which is what I think needs to be done. So let me pose one hypothetical that we can talk about maybe during the call, but now suppose I'm a governor and I set up a system where I say, look, you want me to arrange a meeting for you with someone in my cabinet? You want me to set up a meeting for you with some other government official who works in my administration? You pay me $10,000. And I'm just going to put that money in my pocket. That's not going to be disclosed anywhere, reported on any campaign finance forms. That's just a gift to me. And in exchange, I'll get you in the room. I'll set up that meeting for you. I'll tell my subordinate to take the meeting. I'm not promising to influence what the ultimate decision is, but I'll get you in the room so you can make your pitch. And if you don't pay me, you don't get the meeting. I think most people would think that a system like that would be corrupt. That's a pay-for-access system that most people would find, I believe, corrupt. And yet after the court's holding now in McDonnell, that's not a bribe. Even though there's a direct agreement to act in exchange for a secret undisclosed gift, that's no longer a bribe because the court has said, well, setting up a meeting can never be an official act. And I think that's the problem with this opinion, is focusing just on one side of the equation instead of on an entire corrupt agreement. The essence of public corruption is a public official who's acting not for the good of all, as they are elected to do and sworn to do, but instead is acting to benefit someone who is privately paying them off. And that's what is happening. That's what happened in the McDonnell case, and that's why it was an unremarkable example of public corruption, in my view. Access, selling access, can indeed be corruption. Access can be critically important. I mean, if two people are competing for a contract, the one who can get in the room and make a face-to-face pitch, I think any business person would tell you, is going to have a leg up, especially if that meeting is arranged and requested by your boss, right? So who gets a meeting like that and who gets a chance to make their pitch should be based on the merits and on the public interest, not on who is paying off the governor. And then just as important as the question of access is the denial of access. Those who get access to the decision makers are only those who are willing to pay. And the regular members of the public who can't afford or don't have the connection to make all these extravagant gifts like Johnny Williams did don't have that same access. So I would argue that the flaw in this analysis is that instead of focusing on the quid pro quo, it focuses exclusively and obsessively on the quo. And that's what allows McDonald's supporters and now the court to suggest that routine political interactions were somehow imperiled by McDonald's conviction. So, for example, Chief Justice Roberts said in the opinion in the section about the quote-unquote significant constitutional concerns that Will mentioned. He said, conscientious public officials arrange meetings for constituents, contact other officials on their behalf, and include them in events all the time. Well, that's true. That's also beside the point. Conscientious public officials also vote on legislation all the time, but that doesn't mean it's okay to do so in exchange for a bribe. And so what you have to focus on is not just what they're doing, but on the entire quid pro quo agreement. They may vote on legislation, but they don't do it in exchange for $175,000 in secret gifts, or they may arrange meetings and make phone calls, but not in exchange for Rolex watch and designer gowns and paying the caterer at my wedding and giving me $120,000 in no interest, no paperwork, quote-unquote, loans. So the idea that this conviction imperiled routine political interactions, I think, is a complete straw man. But it was one advocated by McDonald and his supporters, and now one that the court has accepted. Because if you look at the whole relationship, instead of just focusing on the official action, a campaign contribution case starts off in a completely different footing from a case like this. And this is not a campaign contribution case. Campaign contributions are reported. They're subject to certain legal limits. The public can look at them and say, oh, now I see who's supporting this politician. That's not the case with gifts like this. So I don't think, to use Will's term, that robust political participation, as envisioned by the framers or even as envisioned by the court in something like these election law cases, includes the right to secretly pay someone off and buy them a Rolex and give them all these gifts under the table. That's not part of robust political participation. That's corruption. And the arguments that this conviction, threatened routine political activity, I think, again, was just is a straw man that unfortunately now has been accepted. So as a result of this decision, now government access is for sale. Someone like Johnny Williams is able, through secret gifts, to get access to government officials that the rest of us can't get, that the ordinary citizen can't get. That is the nature of public corruption. Access to government and government officials should be equally available to all. But I think, unfortunately, as a result of this decision, now public officials are free to grant access only to the highest bidder. So with that, I will turn things over to Steve.
Thanks a lot, Professor. I think shifting gears a little bit, because we are talking about public corruption, and I believe this is going to have some implications on campaign finance law, and that's what I'd like to focus at least my initial opening comments on, as well as political participation, which I think is inextricably tied to free speech. First of all, it's interesting to mention campaign finance generally. A big decision happened yesterday from the United States Supreme Court, and that was a denial of a case, Delaware Strong Families, coming up out of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And by letting the Third Circuit's decision stand, We're now in a position of yet another circuit that is allowing for all-encompassing disclosure on what I consider de minimis political expenditures that don't even necessarily relate to elections. So the disclosure train moves forward. I certainly appreciate Justice Thomas for filing a dissent in seeking that he would have granted cert to that case, and Justice Alito opining the same thing without a written opinion. Nevertheless, in the fallout of the Citizens United case with disclosure continues full forward, and at the state level in certain courts of appeals and at many state Supreme Courts, campaign finance as far as a red tape for political participation continues to get a rubber stamp from the United States Supreme Court, and that's unfortunate. But I believe by an 8-0 opinion in McDonnell that there is a strong message here that although, and this is goes back to Justice Breyer's comments in during oral arguments in McDonnell, that, hey, I dissented in Citizens United. Nevertheless, the court in a unanimous ruling, I think, has sent a strong message that criminalization, the use of criminal law to go after these public corruption cases or in campaign finance in particular, which is only justified based on the corruption or its appearance when it comes to direct limits on campaign financing. I think that there's a strong message here that criminal law is not the way to go about this. And indeed, there have been, and I think there will be some effects on some ongoing campaign finance cases at the state level. And I did discuss this earlier, but I think now I can throw out there a case, and I discussed this on a previous teleform, excuse me, but the case Carey versus Texas, which is pending, and it's been pending at the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals since last November, was submitted. And I think the court was waiting on the McDonnell ruling and can now say that the act of running for office or continuing to run for office are not official acts for which someone could be bribed. This was a case, and I believe a case of prosecutorial overreach, where a couple financed an election of a judge to the tune of about $500,000, which is way above the legal limit, or excuse me, it was about $200,000. That would have been subject to a civil penalty under the law of up to $500,000. But instead of being charged with giving illegal campaign contributions, they were charged with making bribes to run for office or bribes to continue running for office, or the third alternative theory that once this judge was elected, she was going to rule favorably in their family law case that was going to be pending in front of her once she took office. Now, I agree that that latter one, one of three, is actually an official act. But I think following McDonnell, there's pretty strong persuasive. It is a separate statute, a state statute in Texas. But I think this is a pretty persuasive argument that you can't say that the act of running for office is going to be an official act under which a public official can take, and certainly not something that we're going to call a quid pro quo bribery. So I hope the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals will get around to ruling and ruling favorably. And that's just one example of these ongoing cases where instead of pursuing civil campaign finance prosecutions, that they become criminal and they become pretty nasty. So hopefully that's gonna have a positive effect. I want to turn here to the idea as well. I think this kind of spells a certain element that we're seeing in campaign finance is a lot of groups that are filing campaign finance complaints, a lot of campaigns that are filing campaign finance complaints against their opponents have a pretty, it's almost become routine that instead of just filing them, and we'll talk federal, instead of just filing a complaint with the Federal Election Commission, they tend to also loop in the Department of Justice. It's practically routine now. It's, well, Federal Election Commission, here's our complaint. And by the way, DOJ, we think this might be a knowing and willful violation of campaign finance law, and you should launch a criminal investigation. Thankfully, the Department of Justice has been pretty hesitant to do that. I think they might be even more hesitant to do that now in the wake of McDonnell, because particularly if you think the bribery, the honest services statute might have been vague, trust me, most campaign finance laws, you could drive a truck through them. They're so full of holes. So particularly a lot of talk about campaign finance coordination, this idea that campaigns are illegally coordinating with super PACs and things of that nature. Again, is it directly on point? No, but I think it speaks to the idea that, listen, you can't be just investigating and bringing criminal charges against people over things that are so intricately tied to political campaigning, to political speech. So I'm encouraged about that. And finally, my remaining time, a common criticism, and I think Senator John McCain made a lot of this in the wake of the Citizens United ruling, and it's still a very common refrain, is to say, well, look at these Supreme Court justices making these rulings. It's like they don't know anything about the political process. They don't know anything about campaigning. And I don't mean to be mean about it, but to Professor Eliazon's hypothetical, I'm just floored. I mean, what planet is that hypothetical on? And I speak with experience, and I was with the qualifications that I was a lobbyist for 5 years at the state level. I understand there are 49 states, and I understand federal lobbying. They all may be very different from my experience. But this idea that there would be a politician would actually ask anybody, forget $10,000. I mean, I'd be hesitant for someone asking for $20 or for you to buy them lunch for an introduction to somebody, for setting up a meeting. I think we need to be very careful that, and I think this was a great example, and this is how the Supreme Court closes the McDonnell ruling, to say, listen, there's really bad facts here, but we are not in the business of just making a ruling based on this one case. We have to look at all the other things out there. And I think that overall, to put that hypothetical out there and to suggest that this kind of, that anyone with very, very rare exceptions would open up a sort of system where they're only going to introduce people, particularly how hard is it to get a meeting with this hypothetical person that the person's charging for? Are they in a prison cell somewhere? Are they on an island that you can't get to? There has to be a little bit of realism brought into this. And I think that as terrible as that hypothetical sounds, there has to be a little bit of reality brought into this. And in my experience, I think that anyone ever asked a lobbyist, even a registered lobbyist asked to do that, would be so taken aback and would frankly be put in a very powerful position, politically speaking, to have some serious dirt on anyone if they were trying to keep that kind of thing under wraps. This was a very rare kind of situation. I mean, Johnny Williams, you know, talk about one of the biggest suckers to ever walk the earth, to be handing out the kind of money with so little promise to him. Nevertheless, and I agree, I will agree, this is corruption. It's just not the kind of corruption we can be regulating under the law. And there are many other solutions to this, political solutions. And hey, term limits, Governor McDonnell only got to serve that one term. So that should serve as my opening statement. And I certainly look forward to more discussion. So I turn it over to Tara.
Hello, thank you. Well, I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, that my perspective will probably be diametrically opposite to that of Steve, because we, for instance, at the Campaign Legal Center, were counsel to Delaware in the Delaware Strong Families case that Steve mentioned, and we were happy at the result that the Supreme Court declined to hear whether or not the Third Circuit correctly upheld a very strong state-level disclosure law. So that, of course, is my perspective. In terms of the McDonnell decision, I would say my response was first disappointment, then relief, and then moving into confusion. So I will detail a little bit those responses. First, the CLC, my group, was disappointed at the narrow construction of the statute. Will and Randall have already described in far more detail what that was. At the very least, it will make prosecutors' lives more difficult in pursuing public corruption cases. But in terms of the relief, we're relieved that the court did not make this case a First Amendment case, at least not in and of itself. McDonald's most radical defense was presented in his cert petition. People may forget that he argued that the meetings and events he planned for Johnny Williams were nothing more than, quote unquote, provision of mere access, and consequently were, quote unquote, constitutionally protected and an intrinsic part of our political system. In support of this, he pointed to the court's recent 5-4 decisions in both Citizens United and McCutcheon. Both cases had struck down campaign finance laws under the First Amendment, and both had questioned whether officials' provision of, quote, access to campaign supporters was a form of corruption that could sustain campaign finance law. So this was sort of a frightening argument for a campaign finance advocate. I think, however, that this argument was really a misreading of Citizens United and McCutcheon. Even a very expansive interpretation of those cases would not lead to the conclusion that they created some sort of freestanding First Amendment right to purchase political access. The court there, in those cases, did not really hold that purchasing or the act of giving or spending in and of itself was protected by the First Amendment. Instead, it held rightly or wrongly, in our view, that the First Amendment protects certain campaign-related activities, for instance, corporate independent expenditures, even if they result in influence and access to the speaker. So thankfully, the court in McDonald did not really entertain this argument. McDonald's most aggressive argument was probably aimed at the five-justice conservative majority that had decided Citizens United and McCutcheon, or as it was in McCutcheon, it was a four-justice plurality. And in fact, his position softened between his cert petition and his merits brief. And I think this is no surprise because between those two filings, Justice Scalia passed away. And with that, probably took away any fifth vote to adopt McDonald's very strong position that the actual purchase of access was somehow enshrined in our Constitution. But now to turn to confusion or concern and confusion. Although the McDonald court did not take up this First Amendment angle, there were troubling aspects of how Justice Roberts, who wrote the opinion, discussed his significant constitutional concerns, which to some extent seemed to drive the result. The vision of politics that was articulated in Citizens United and McCutcheon seemed still sort of alive in yesterday's decision, even if McDonald didn't explicitly reference those cases ultimately. So with respect to his constitutional concerns, Robert explained that the government's broad reading of an official act definition would imperil, and I quote here, the basic compact underlying representative government. And this compact was that, quote, public officials will hear from their constituents and act appropriately on their concerns, whether it is a union official worried about a plant closing or the homeowners who wonder why it took 5 days to restore power to their neighborhood after a storm. My response really is, give me a break. These hypotheticals bear no resemblance to what happened in McDonald. And the CLC, my group, has been long perturbed by Justice Roberts' tendency to recast big donors and now apparently would-be bribers as quote-unquote constituents. Now, $177,000 in bribes is not really a constituent's request for assistance, and Johnny Williams was hardly an ordinary constituent himself. And our concern is that this terminology or these type of analogies seem to be aimed at obscuring the real results of these types of decisions, which is that narrowing the bribery law will likely protect big donors and wealthy bribers, not your average citizen. I think the constitutional discussion also creates confusion when we move to sort of the next question, which is what next? How do we respond to this decision if we are concerned about its results on the integrity of government? Could Congress, for instance, amend the definition of official act in the federal bribery statute to both clarify and expand the term to include activities that can be characterized as access? Is that open to us still? The decision clearly was one based upon the statute, but again, these lurking constitutional concerns make the playing field a little less certain. The Campaign Legal Center also, of course, would recommend to any state or locality that wanted to fight this problem that they could, of course, adopt campaign finance laws or gift laws. Virginia had neither law at the time that McDonald's lavish gift acceptance was going on. They had no campaign contribution limit, and they had no limit on gifts that could be received. This seems like an easy first step. But that said, as you know, the very cursory discussion of Citizens United and McCutcheon has shown, there is still some question about the degree to which concerns about the purchase of political access and influence without sort of a direct quid pro quo can support campaign finance laws. So on the one hand, we recommend pass a campaign finance law. This will help staunch any tide of corruption that flows from the McDonald decision. But on the other hand, we're still not clear about the parameters that campaign finance laws can occupy, given the recent trend in Citizens United, McCutcheon, and other decisions by the Roberts Court to cut back on the scope of such laws. And of course, as a final point, I would say that we are, of course, in a period of transition for the Supreme Court. As I already alluded to, Justice Scalia passed away, and we now seem to have a 4-4 split on the current court about the degree to which campaign finance laws can address more insidious forms of corruption like access, like influence, like sort of more hidden ways that officials might press their benefactors' interests. So it's something that I think will be an open question, and McDonald's discussion of the, quote, significant constitutional concerns don't bring a whole lot of clarity in the end. Thanks.
All right, well, we'll give all of our speakers a chance to respond to one another here. But while we do that, I want to go ahead and open up the audience question queue so that our questioners can get in line for that. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. All right, so if you have a question, please do hit star and then the pound key. While we wait to see who might line up, Will, do you have anything that you want to respond to that you heard after your statement?
Yes, thank you, Will. I'd like to make a few points in response to Randall's opening remarks, and then a few, if I could, in response to Tara. So first, with respect to Randall's comments, Randall correctly pointed out that Governor McDonnell was not actually charged with federal bribery in this case, and seemed to argue that that was somehow indicative that of a stronger case against Governor McDonnell. But I actually think it's an indication that there's a weaker case against Governor McDonnell. Instead of relying upon the federal bribery statute, which actually articulates quid pro quo agreement, the federal government instead relied upon and I'm not saying anything that the Supreme Court hasn't already unanimously said in Skilling, a vague honest services fraud statute and then a vague Hobbs Act statute. In fact, I think it's worth emphasizing that in Skilling, the court unanimously found the honest services fraud statute to be vague. And the only question that the justices divided upon was whether that vagueness could be cured. And similarly, we see here in McDonnell, I don't think there's any dispute in the opinion that, and in fact, I would argue that the identification of significant constitutional concerns and focus on vagueness confirms that the court considers these vague statutes to be, in fact, vague. And it is only these narrowing constructions that with respect to McDonnell, the narrowing construction on official act that saves these statutes from being unconstitutionally vague. So I understand Randall's point about focusing on the corrupt agreement, and that is indeed where the focus is. But part of that agreement is it's an agreement to perform, to receive a thing of value in exchange for performance of certain specific official acts. And the question becomes whether or not these types of acts can be official actions. And it's not to say, I actually don't read the court's opinion as saying that in every single case, the types of actions here can never be an official action. The question is, are they tied to an exercise of government power? And here, it seems to me that there just wasn't evidence of that. So I think it's right to point out that he wasn't charged with bribery. I think that actually makes this a weaker case against Governor McDonnell because the government had to rely on these vague statutes. It was only by an agreement between the parties, between Governor McDonnell and the government, that official action and that component and the quid pro quo of an official action actually came into sort of guide the Hobbs Act and the honest services fraud statutes. I also say in response to Randall that he is right from a certain perspective that you could look at this case and see it as garden variety public corruption. But if you look at it that way, that's only because since the Supreme Court's decision in Skilling, and this has been talked about by a number of scholars, the government has shoehorned a variety of conduct into the supposedly core understanding of bribery and kickbacks. And in fact, there's been a survey done of roughly 600 public corruption decisions post the Supreme Court's Skilling decision that found that in a number of instances where the government couldn't actually make a case under bribery, under the federal bribery statutes, they would just rely on a more nebulous statute or traditional mail and wire fraud or even RICO potentially. I mean, so the government would just rely on another tool in its toolbox to bring the case if it couldn't shoehorn the conduct into the honest services fraud statute or Hobbs Act. So I can understand from the perspective of the government why they would just consider this to be yet another instance of corruption because the government has characterized a myriad of conduct as corruption depending upon how it views certain facts. With respect to Tara, just a few comments in response. There are two different constitutional concerns in play. There's the vagueness concern that I've talked about with respect to some of Randall's comments, and then also these First Amendment concerns. And I would say that there is a unity in that because what a person understands as a bribe has both vagueness and First Amendment implications. This is a point from Buckley versus Vallejo, where the court says that we cannot simply just cast a wide net calling everything that we don't like a bribe, because that could actually chill political conduct and chill political activity and end up targeting political participation simply because it's robust. So there's no argument from the government that a campaign contribution can be a quid. And if the quo is simply anything that has, over a period of time that is just one in a series of steps to exercise influence, then you're really left with just a prosecutor making a characterization game. And that is not something that I think is actually respectful of the First Amendment. And I know Tara was making the point about relying upon Citizens United and McCutcheon as extreme and not frightening and not at all representative of the types of examples that were actually in the court's opinion about a union official or constituents taking an official out to a baseball game. But what I would suggest is that, well, compare Sun Diamond, which is no doubt a public corruption case, with McConnell and Citizens United and what they characterize as mere ingratiation and access and not corruption. In McConnell, there's a discussion of a number of instances where there was a promise of special access to candidates and senior government officials in exchange for large soft money contributions, including White House coffees rewarding major donors with access to President Clinton, or a businessman named Roger Tamarez, who candidly acknowledged that he gave $300,000 to the Democratic Party to gain the federal government's support for an oil line project in the caucuses. When Citizens United concluded that ingratiation and access are in any event not corruption, it cited as support this exact discussion in McConnell that were characterized as certain donations made to gain access to elected officials. So I do think that the First Amendment and the public corruption statutes exist in the same universe. And I know that there are attempts sometimes to act as if they should just be ships passing in the night. There are campaign finance cases and there are public corruption cases. But we should not be cabining the First Amendment, and I don't think we should be cabining it based on what is essentially a trust us theory from the government.
Professor Eliason, do you want to respond to anything that Will said there?
Sure, just a couple quick things. In respect to what Will just said, I just point out I don't think it's fair to criticize the government for not charging McDonnell with the federal bribery statute. They couldn't. It applies only to federal public officials, and that's why the government uses the Hobbs Act and honest services fraud in bribery cases. Those are the most common ways to charge state and local bribery. So there's nothing really unusual or nefarious about the fact that they use those statutes instead of 18 U.S.C. 201. But I do think there is a good argument to be made that using the definition from 201 is not appropriate to define bribery for all purposes. And the government agreed early on in this case to do that, and I think they could be regretting that decision now. But that's getting a little far afield, I think, for our purposes. And then in response to just Steve's suggestion that my hypothetical is unrealistic, I don't think it's unrealistic at all. I think if you look at the blatant conduct in some public corruption cases with people like Rod Blagojevich and Duke Cunningham and other cases like that, the suggestion that somebody might set up a pay-for-access system, just like a pay-to-play system, it's not really that unrealistic at all. And I think it's also kind of ironic to criticize that hypothetical, because if you want to talk about what planet is a hypothetical on, I think you can address that question to Chief Justice Roberts. You know, what planet are his hypotheticals from? The idea that a politician is going to be indicted for bribery for performing routine constituent services and trying to find out why the power was out for 5 days or whatever example it was that he used. I mean, these are just silly. The idea that those would result in public corruption cases and that routine constituent services are imperiled by prosecuting someone like Williams for giving the kind of gifts he did to McDonnell. But then finally, the reason hypothetical is relevant and important, I think, is that it shows now what the law allows. As the court said in this opinion, we can't be concerned only with the facts of this case. We have to be concerned with, you know, the universe of what's going to be allowed after our holding. Well, after this holding now, something like my hypothetical would be legal. And I think that fact suggests that it's a flawed holding and a flawed idea of public corruption and bribery. That's all I have for now.
Steve, before you respond to that, I want to remind our audience again to hit star and then the pound key if they want to queue up for questions once we've completed this rebuttal round here. Steve, you can go ahead.
Just a very quick response to that, and Tara mentioned this, you know, the idea that prosecutors' lives might be more difficult, and Professor Eliazon just alluded to Rod Blagojevich, and I would encourage anyone on this call who wants to follow public corruption cases to set a Google alert for bribery. First of all, you're going to get every day sent to your inbox a nice summary of a lot of bribery stories from around the world, and you're first of all going to realize that the United States is still pretty not corrupt compared to the rest of the world. But then you're also going to see a lot of cut-and-dry bribery cases happening in the United States that are not going to be affected by this ruling. One of those, I should add, is the Rod Blagojevich case. You know, we often refer to public corruption as this series of winks and nods. And I was thinking this morning of an old Fresh Prince episode where Carlton Banks knew he had this job because they gave him the wink and the gun and then spent the rest of the episode lamenting that he didn't get it, even though they gave him the wink and the gun. I mean, what's going on? And this is the thing, that Rod Blagojevich wasn't doing winks and guns. He was soliciting money for a private foundation or for a position from Obama for a position on an existing private foundation. There you had, in exchange for him appointing someone that the White House wanted to be appointed to the senatorial position. There you had an official act in exchange for actual money. But even the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, in a great opinion by Judge Easterbrook, had to throw out a few of those convictions because they included in the jury instructions the offer of not only if Rod would receive a White House appointment in exchange for making that Senate appointment, that would be corrupt, certainly, but not bribery, because it's an official act in exchange for another official act. It's political log rolling. It's unseemly, but it is not bribery. So even in a case where you have a guy on tape, as you had Blagojevich, pretty much telling, it seems, anyone who would listen about how he was going to sell this Senate seat, you had a little bit of prosecutorial overreach that had to be curtailed. And I should add, it didn't affect Blagojevich's sentence. They were still able to uphold his sentence on all the other things he was convicted of.
Well, Tara, do you have anything to add before we move to audience Q&A?
Sure, just two responses. First, just sort of a correction, perhaps. I think this is Will who brought up whether or not I was arguing that the First Amendment should be completely cabined away from public corruption cases, and that was not really my hoped-for point. I thought, or we thought, that an argument that there is actual First Amendment right to purchase access and influence, almost a First Amendment right to bribe, was something that was frightening. However, you know, a public corruption case, a bribery case, there certainly could be a First Amendment dimension. That was not something that I was denying. So maybe there is a bit of a misunderstanding. In terms of his other point, which is that the McConnell records, that is an earlier campaign finance case, detailed many, many instances where there seemed to be a trade of campaign contributions for various forms of access and maybe stays in the White House and all sorts of goodies from politicians, and would we want to criminalize all this, or would it be appropriate to criminalize all this conduct? I think there's two answers to that. One, that as we've been discussing to some extent, the bribery statute or a criminal conviction requires evidence of a corrupt agreement or a real quid pro quo. That does offer protection. It seemed that the justices in oral arguments sort of waived that off, but again, there has to be shown that there is an explicit or a near explicit agreement to actually exchange the quid for the quo before you can even have criminal conviction under the bribery statute. So it's simply not the case that any time a campaign supporter somehow gets something nice that they are going to give rise to a criminal case. Secondly, you know, all the kind of political favors and goodies that campaign supporters get are not necessarily official acts because they don't even meet the definition. An official act, as we all know, reading the statute, is an act or decision on a governmental matter, case, controversy, et cetera. It has to actually go to some sort of policy issue or governmental decision. So a nice little meet and greet, a photo op, something where nothing of substance is discussed or there's really no governmental question there, that's, again, not going to ever give rise to a criminal prosecution under the bribery laws. And so a great deal of the kind of political kind of meet and greet and pressing the flesh and kissing babies and all that that may happen with between officials and their campaign supporters are simply not going to be official acts under any reading of the statute. And finally, you know, in terms of we can't criminalize anything or we can't criminalize everything, I would respond, well, maybe we should start to criminalize certain things. Not everything about our current political system is so up and up and functioning so well that we can't reassess. I have a certain frustration that it seems that there's a bit of a everyone does it excuse going on in McDonald and other cases where, you know, if all the politicians are doing this, thus we must interpret the law to make this type of activity non-criminal. Well, that's not necessarily the only answer. We shouldn't be reverse engineering the laws to what might be a dismal status quo in terms of political transactional activity. That doesn't mean that we should criminalize everything or that we should create vague laws or, you know, have prosecutors overreach. But simply because politicians do it is not enough for it to be legal in my eyes. Thank you.
All right. Well, we were able to lure one questioner onto our line so far. We'll go to that caller now. I hope that you will hit star and then the pound key to be the next question after this one. You can hit those keys at any time.
Hi, it's a very interesting discussion. I'm Michael Chart, and I practice in New York City. And it's no secret that the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District has embarked upon a series of trials and investigations focused on the leadership of the New York State Legislature as well as the governor's office. At the bottom of page 23, going on to the top of page 24 of this decision, the court focuses in on what it refers to as significant federalism concerns, and makes the point that, we're going to be pretty tough on the notion of the federal government and the DOJ setting standards of good government for local and state officials. I'm wondering if any of the folks that are on the call have any views as to how this decision might affect what's taking place here in New York.
This is Steve Klein. So I just weigh in that I do appreciate the end of the opinion. Certainly touches on a bunch of different issues that, you know, one might call victim, but I think are really important. And as to what the specifics, what the fallout might look like in the state of New York, that's anybody's guess. I've seen some speculation relating to certain ongoing prosecutions as far as the official act. But I think it's important to look here as the specifics of this case that McDonnell was operating under laws of the Commonwealth of Virginia, one of the oldest democracies in history, recorded history. And it involved an allowance to accept these gifts under, you know, vague laws that allowed for non-disclosure of these gifts. And those have, my understanding is, they've been remedied during this ongoing case. So, But that's the issue here, is that the federal government kind of using, in these instances, compliance with state law against the defendant. And I think that's probably one of the biggest federalism concerns that was going into this.
This is Randall. Just in response to that, you often hear that what McDonald did not violate state law. I don't think that's correct. It's true that Virginia state law allowed him to accept gifts, but it doesn't allow any politician to accept gifts as part of a quid pro quo bribery. And in fact, if you look at Virginia bribery law, Virginia state bribery law makes it a crime for a public official to accept a thing of value in exchange for, among other things, an exercise of his discretion as a public official. So there's not this quote-unquote official act language that the court is so focused on in McDonald's case. I think based on the jury's findings, the jury would have found that he violated Virginia bribery law as well, and that he accepted these gifts from Johnny Williams in exchange for exercising his discretion to contact his staff and try to set up these meetings.
All right, we have three questions on the line now pending. Please, callers, do keep your questions brief and end them with a question mark so we can get to as many of these as possible.
Yes, this is Daniel Ogden from Dallas, Texas. In my view, this was a political prosecution of Governor McDonald, and I think the result of that was seen in the subsequent governor's race. I'm wondering if William and Stephen, whether you would agree with that viewpoint.
So this is Will. I'll weigh in. I don't want to speak to the motivations behind the prosecution of Governor McDonald. I have a very high regard for the U.S. Attorney's Office, particularly in the Eastern District of Virginia. So I don't want to cast any aspersions like that at all. But I do think what you see, I think there's a difference between a political prosecution and a criminalization of politics. And I think that latter concern is something that we should really be focusing on. If we're going to have a definition of bribery where the quid can be anything, it can be anything, and the quo could be, according to the government's view, anything that's a series of steps in an attempt to exercise influence where an agreement doesn't even necessarily need to exist at the outset, but is just inferred over time, it is very difficult to understand how, number one, anything at all could never be a bribe, and number two, or official action rather, excuse me, and number two, it's very difficult to understand how exactly a public official or anyone interacting with a public official can know what the law is and can comply with the law. And that does leave the door open for a criminalization of involvement in political activity. Professor Lyson made the point a number of times that he actually doesn't think that the statutory definition of official act is what we should be bounded to. I think that that's not a correct way to read Skilling. I think that debate's probably getting into the weeds a little bit, but the fact is that if it's not the definition of official action, well, then you're just opening up the door even more to being able to criminalize ordinary political activity with a guarantee from the government that they wouldn't do that. So we just trust them rather than know what the law is. And I don't think that's how the legal system should work.
Anybody else want to touch on that before we move to the next question?
This is Tara. I would just raise the another sort of issue in response to your question about whether this was politically motivated. One of the critiques of what was seen as a broad interpretation of the federal bribery standards was that this type of approach allows for selective enforcement, which is, I think, what is informing your question, that broad laws allow prosecutors to sort of pick and choose and create double standards or different standards for different political actors. But, you know, my response would be that one way to cut off selective enforcement is not simply to narrow or get rid of public corruption laws, but to pass prophylactic or preventative laws such as gift laws or ethics laws or campaign finance laws. If you have a situation where governors or officials are allowed to accept $100,000 worth of campaign contributions or gifts, you're going to give rise to an atmosphere which may or may not allow a prosecutor to cherry pick. If they had gift laws and campaign contribution laws on the books, you could have cut off this entire scenario from happening before it even took off the ground. So, again, I think that turning to prophylactic laws, such as campaign finance laws, can ameliorate your concerns without necessarily getting rid of getting rid of tough public corruption laws.
This is Steve Klein, and I would weigh in because this kind of plays off my last answer regarding the legality in Virginia, that Tara and I have common ground on the gift laws. I really do think this there's no problem with strict liability statutes preventing politicians, federal or state, from accepting gifts, you know, perhaps outside of immediate family above a certain value. I have absolutely no objection to that, and that would have certainly served as a good prophylactic measure. We certainly part ways on campaign finance law, though.
All right. Well, we're about at the end of our allotted time here, and we still have two questions on the line. Is it okay, panelists, if we try to power through these two questions with a little speed round?
Sure.
All right. So, callers, the panelists are generally allowed to give a few extra minutes here, so please do keep your questions very brief.
Hi, this is Francis Menton of the Manhattan Contrarian website, and I would say I have very low regard for our politicians in New York, but even far lower regard for the prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. Part of these prosecutions is the proof of an agreement, but the problem isn't the big problem that the agreement is proved by the testimony of the alleged briber, who, of course, is also subject to theoretical prosecution, and then, of course, they'll testify to a supposed agreement, which is some kind of an oral agreement, and I'm thinking specifically of what happened in the Skelos prosecution. Could you comment on that?
This is Steve Klein, and I think you raise an interesting point, because this is a case, I mean, Johnny Williams in this case, I don't know if he pulled a proverbial Godfather 2 on this one, but it kind of seemed like it. I mean, from what I've seen, and I have not read the entire trial record or even his entire testimony, but certainly what the state or what the prosecution relied on in their Fourth Circuit briefing and their SCOTUS briefing indicated that he was, I mean, for the immunity deal he received, Johnny Williams provided very little in the way of proving that actual agreement. Very skittish at best. Yeah, it was agreement. It helped me. He made him. I mean, either there's, again, we can play conspiracy theory and think something else is going on here, which fine. But I really believe, given the immunity deal he had, he was telling the truth and really is really, really got suckered pretty good here with the wink and the nod.
This is Randall. If Williams was telling the truth, then McDonald should have been convicted. I mean, the crime is the agreement, not what he actually does, which is another thing emphasized in the Supreme Court's opinion, and that I think the Fourth Circuit now has to consider, because it's not just a question of what McDonald actually did, but did he have an agreement with Williams to try to perform official acts under this new standard, and that's the issue now after the court's opinion. But more generally, the credibility of a cooperator is always at issue in a case like this, and that's the classic argument, and that's the classic fodder for cross-examination. And, you know, McDonnell had great lawyers. Williams testified. McDonnell testified. They were both cross-examined. And the jury found and, you know, convicted McDonnell. So I think if you believe in the jury system, this is a classic credibility question. Was there an agreement or not? The jury heard both sides. They saw the witnesses. They heard the evidence, and they found that there was.
All right, well, let's take our last caller.
Hi, my name is Don Perdue. I'm a lawyer in private practice in D.C. Thanks for hanging in there to take my question. We've talked about the quid, we've talked about the quo. My question's about the pro. How explicit does the agreement have to be? I have a case pending in trial court right now in which my clients allege that a person, a non-lawyer, practices before the Historic Preservation Review Board, offered bribes over a number of years to key officials, and then got favorable decisions. Our evidence does not show that she offered the bribes for a decision specifically adverse to my clients. It was more like a retainer agreement, a retainer bribe. And how does the Supreme Court's ruling affect something like that?
Well, this is Will. I'll take an initial stab at that. I would just say, with respect to the opinion itself, the opinion in a number of places cites Evans versus United States, which Justice Kennedy's opinion in that case is really the sort of launching off point for the stream of benefits view of bribery, where over time you can have an agreement that's inferred through knowing winks and nods. That is, and we've seen in circuit court cases like the Siegelman case in the 11th Circuit, I think, for example, where this stream of benefits view has been adopted, and that explicit is held to not mean to be express. The court really doesn't touch on that too much. I think that the court may have been inclined to touch on that had the vagueness concerns been more affirmatively addressed by the court, but they were able to have an understanding of official action that, in their view, kept these statutes on the narrower side of vague, on the constitutionally side of vague, through a narrow construction. So that I don't think they really bear upon that view, but the fact remains is that the stream of benefits view of bribery is something that has a lot of power at the lower courts. And I do think it's something that the court will have to contend with at some point or another, because these are the kinds of cases that can be brought and are brought with frequency.
Yeah, and this is Randall. I agree with that. And the court, as Will mentioned, cites Evans and says again in this opinion, the agreement does not need to be explicit. So it's been pretty clear for a while that you can prove corrupt agreements through winks and nods, and the court has said otherwise it would be too easy to evade the corruption laws. And I don't think this particular opinion really changes that.
All right, well, does anybody have a 15-second fragment left unsaid on the subject here before we adjourn?
I'd just like to thank everybody. This has really been enjoyable, and I appreciate getting to speak with you all. So thank you.
Second that.
Thank you.
Well, thank all of you for giving us such great analysis at such short notice here. I know that our audience appreciated it, and we here at the Federal Society certainly did as well. Thanks, everyone who called in and asked their questions. Our next Teleform call is scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. We'll be discussing the FCC's set-top box rules with Commissioner Ajit Pai. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.